Thank you very much, Macau, and also thank you very much, Anthony. I feel in a very bad position because actually I agree with you, Macau. It's time to think and reflect. And whereas I'm sitting now in the position to continue talking, but we want to profit from both your presence here and take us another like 20 minutes to discuss a little bit many topics you covered. To begin with one question to you, Anthony. In both your book but also today, you asked the question how to make international law useful. And in your book, in your conclusions, you are talking about you're asking which are the agents who can promote this issue, who are promoting global justice. And I would like to know from you, who are our allies here and now to move towards global justice and use law in a good sense?
Well, that's a very large issue, and I didn't feel really confident about being able to address it in my book. But I do think that we have to adopt a very broad perspective on this, and I think it goes back to some of the things that Macau says, that we shouldn't see a particular position as the location of power in these types of circumstances. I do feel that TWAIL is important because my hope is that most people are people of goodwill. That if they happen to be working in particular institutions, the World Bank or the IMF or whatever it is, and if they give some thought to these types of issues, they might rethink what they do, just as people in NGOs or development agencies, that these people actually might consider what they do in a more critical way. And what the outcome of that would be is something I can't be very clear about. I was very touched some years ago when somebody wrote to me saying something like, I've worked in international development for many years, and I wish I had read your book at the time I began this type of work. And I felt it was very good of them to. Well, firstly, I felt, of course, honored that they should think that my work was useful, because it's very theoretical, but at least it develops a sort of a particular idea of practice. But I do see this as being people everywhere. I don't see any particular agents of change. Now, I think there's a sense sometimes that we feel if only we could get to the Supreme Court, or if only we could get to the ICJ, or if only we could get to this particular location of power. At one time, I was thinking, well, if I can work for an international organization, then somehow I can change the processes by which this can take place. I'm very glad that many TWAIL people are actually very practically involved, like Macau, our colleague James Gathy, like our colleague Obiora Okafor, who's somewhere here, is working within the human rights system. But I do think there isn't an easy answer to say there's one location, one decisive location of power, or that there's one particular actor who can play a crucial role in this. We might think, if only I can become president of the United States, then I'll change the whole posture of the United States internationally and so forth. It did not really work for, President Obama. So it's all very diffuse, and I feel we can't really say there's any particular location. I think everyone can make some contribution, but it's difficult to predict. And I would also go back to what Macau said in terms of, we have to think of the political. It's all in the realm of political activity. Reparations, for example, so much of it is driven by a political process, not the law. So I think we should see it in that broader sense, and I think that's one of the good things about this event, that we have a very broad community of people concerned about this issue, but approaching it from very different locations and positions.
Thank you. You just talked about your general doubts in law, which I agree to, and you said that the human rights movement has to be politicized and look much more to economy than it did before, and their big achievement was scandalizing the despotism, but now the next step has to come. But don't you think that particularly in countries like South Africa or like India, and we will hear more about India tomorrow, there are social movements who try to use the law as a tool, but not as the only tool, not hoping for the one instance, the one judge, the one court, but using a court, for example, like you, Esther, and the others in New York, using courts to put an issue on the table again, using courts to trigger discussion, using courts, using lawsuits, using legal discussions as defense lines, like the absolute prohibition of torture as a defense line. So, I agree with your critique, but aren't there movements right now who already overcome that, you know, that very naive and restricted view, focused view on law?
No, so I think that if you are a young law school student and you are thinking about what law classes to take, in the United States, human rights is an elective. It is not something that is required. You have to think about what course you are going to take. Some civil rights courses are also electives and so on. And what I've always taught my students is to think of legal education, at least in the United States, as a theater of experimentation, of trying to get skills to do multiple things, to do many things. Because legal skills are not simply skills, as far as I teach law, not just about traditional lawyering, or looking at concretely at documents and so on. It's about thinking broadly about society, and I think of lawyers, or like to think of lawyers, as intellectuals. This is why I'm not interested in a narrow reading of the law. If we take that perspective, I have to say that that each one of us must take a slice of the problem. As we come out of law school, each one of us must take a slice of the problem. So in 2015, for example, I went to work for the World Bank for a year. And part of my brief there was to help the bank develop a human rights policy or human rights guidance. I did not succeed. But I tried, okay? I have worked with colleagues in India who are interested, for example, in decriminalizing homosexuality, thinking about that as a terrain of contest, all right? And using the courts for that purpose. I do not impugn those efforts. I think they are great efforts. What my argument really is about if you're a big tree trunk that you want to bring down, it might be the tactical thing to do might be to plow around the trunk first. To weaken it so that you can go for the roots at some point, But do not forget that the trunk is not going to be taken away by your plowing around it. At some point, you're going to have to face the tree trunk mano a mano. Okay? And the question for me is for us, because I think that the use of the law is the plowing around the tree trunk. What skills are we imparting to our students in the legal academy, to be able not just to plow around the tree trunk, but to take on the tree trunk itself directly at some point. And I think that not very much. We're not doing very much. So that's part of the answer. And I think part of the problem is that we as academics, but also as activists, We have not applied ourselves intellectually to that question. We really haven't. We've accepted certain boundaries as no-go areas or as givens, and so therefore we don't go there. And we don't go there because we think that either it's futile or it will not succeed, or that it has no support. You know, so even on the question of trying to understand the question of economic and social rights, or globalization, or land rights in South Africa, for example, even on that question alone, we are afraid to question the notion of private property as lawyers. And that was, in my view, the biggest bottleneck in South Africa. Okay? If you have, you know, black people who, you know, were, you know, using land that was not theirs, okay, and they are being kicked out of that land, the landowner, who is mostly white, has a right to kick them out. And the Constitutional Court of South Africa is unable to do anything about that because the right to property is absolute. And when this particular, there was a case, in fact, in South Africa, the Grootboom case, those who know the South Africa know this very well, that case came before the courts in South Africa. It came before Justice Albie Sachs. I'm sure you all know Albie Sachs. And Albie Sachs told us, and I don't think I'm giving out private information, he said that when they heard the case, there was nothing they could do for those landless blacks who had invaded that white-owned land, which they were not using. And this white landowner had hundreds and hundreds of acres, just lying fallow. Just lying fallow. Okay? So the question is, Albie Sachs, that they heard the case and the Constitutional Court basically could not do anything. I think the Constitutional Court asked them to go to mediation to see whether they would be allowed to stay there for a few more years as something else was developed. So those are some of the challenges. Are we willing, for example, to confront that question? And I'm not an outlandish individual here saying that I want to abolish private property. I'm not. But I'm just saying that there are issues that require that we rethink some of these fundamental principles. And who is willing to do it? Unless we are willing to do it, then I don't think that we are serious.
So what do you think? I think these were very good and impressive last words for this panel, and we deserve a break. So thanks again, Marco. Thank you, Anthony. And we meet in 20 minutes for the next panel on development policy, asymmetrical trade relations, and global financial system, exactly continuing at that point you just made. So thanks again, and see you in a couple of minutes.